You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. Jobs, of course, wages also, of course, both critical to the health of this economy. Also, though, stuff, just stuff on shelves from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, 19 December is the day and date. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the aforementioned stuff on shelves. Technically, all that stuff is called retail inventories, what companies big and small keep in stock to sell to us. And managing that stuff has been the bane of many a business, also big and small, over the past couple of years, as we have reported, I believe, with some regularity on this program. It's a great expense, all that stuff, buying it and storing it, so the more efficiently companies can do it, and the more astute they can be in knowing what we want to buy, the better. And now, finally, a lot of retailers have managed to start selling off their extra stuff and getting their hands on goods that they have been unable to get previously as they try to strike a normal pre-pandemic inventory balance. But overall, inventory levels are still pretty high, 17% higher in October than a year ago, so says the Commerce Department. So Marketplace's Sabria Minashour took a look at how businesses are trying to wrestle with the long arms of the pandemic economy.
There is this plant you may have seen on TikTok or Instagram. It's called Monstera Albo, big green and white leaves with slits in them. Anyway, it was all the rage for a while, sometimes selling for hundreds of dollars.
Have been really popular for the last 3 or 4 years, and we sold out every month.
Perry Jang is the owner of A Plant Shop. That's his actual name, A Plant Shop. He sells rare and uncommon houseplants on Etsy and eBay. I have, full disclosure, bought a plant from his store. It is still alive. So Jang stocked up on this rare plant, and then
just within like 30 days or 60 days, the demand just quickly just dropped.
He was stuck with the plants in his basement. Plant sales do go down in winter, but he's still trying to whittle down his overall inventory to match demand.
Inventory cost is really high because you have artificial light, water, labor. It's not like paper boxes you can put there and sit there forever.
Inventory management is a problem many a business is facing this year.
Furniture, appliances, home furnishings, electronics.
Brett Ryan is senior U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank. General merchandise stores have it the worst, but other sectors still have the opposite problem.
We still have very low inventories of cars, trucks, parts.
Every sector seems to have its own story about why it has too much or too little to sell, says Ryan. In housing, there was a shortage last year of lumber, so sellers ordered a bunch more. But then interest rates pushed the housing economy into the dumps, and now there's plenty of lumber. Zach Rogers studies supply chain logistics at Colorado State. He says retail is moving in the right direction.
Holiday sales have been strong. Consumer shopping has been, relatively decent. And so we have really gotten through this sort of big lump of inventory that was sitting in the systems in the spring and the early summer.
That said, inventory is still too high. So what do stores with too much stuff do? They do what plant retailer Perry Jang's going to do.
Probably we'll do a big sale soon.
Time to get more plants. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders are still waiting on that Santa Claus rally, I think. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is a big week for housing in this economy, and we kick it off with home builder sentiment. And they are not feeling great, those construction companies. Sentiment was down yet again in December, which tops off a straight year of monthly declines. In fact, just to give you the whole picture, confidence among builders of single-family homes is at the lowest it's been since 2012, except for that first very miserable month of the pandemic back in 2020. Tomorrow morning, we're going to find out just how much, or maybe I should say how much more, rising interest rates have affected new home construction. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has the latest on housing now and housing yet to come.
2022 has been a disorienting year for home builders, says Rick Palacios Jr., director of research at John Burns Real Estate Consulting.
It was a buzzsaw.
Builders were scrambling to find enough materials and workers early in the year. Now, mortgage rates have nearly doubled, so they're pulling back on new projects.
Home builders are really in this mode of reset, clearing the decks.
That's a normal response when demand declines. But the housing market has not really been normal for a while, says Richard Green, who heads the USC Lusk Center for Real Estate.
We went basically 10 years with low levels of housing construction. So even if we got to normal, we're not catching up on that 10 years of lost supply.
That was after the housing crisis in 2008, when new construction all but dried up. Then housing became scarce and expensive as the large millennial generation came of age. Robert Dietz, chief economist with the National Association of Home Builders, says construction couldn't keep up with that demand. He says there's still a deficit of about 1.5 million housing units.
We've called it the five L's, the limiting factors in home building. It's labor, lots, lumber, lending, and then legal and regulatory issues.
Some of those were exacerbated by the pandemic, but he says others are longstanding, including a shortage of construction workers and restrictive zoning. Meanwhile, apartment construction has been thriving, says Anibon Basu, chief economist at Associated Builders and Contractors. He says that should ease rental costs.
Here's the issue. A lot of people don't aspire toward being renters. They don't want to make the landlord rich. They aspire toward being homeowners.
Once mortgage rates settle down again, Basu says, those folks will likely be back in the market for a house, putting pressure on builders again. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
One of the big legacies of the pandemic so far, anyway, is that more people are working from home. Less common, so far, anyway, is something a bit more radical, not working, or more accurately, not working a full five-day week while still getting full pay. Over in the UK, a six-month trial of the four-day work week has just wrapped up, believed to be the biggest study of its kind, 3,000 people in 70 different companies. The results aren't going to be published until February, but the anecdotal evidence is quite positive. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from the English Midlands.
Joe Dance rummages through the reeds next to a large lake looking for one of his favourite animals, the water vole.
I love voles. They're a very elusive creature. Not very many people have seen a water vole at all. They're very, very cute. I hope we get to see one today.
He's been helping here as a nature conservation volunteer now that his job takes only 4 days a week.
This is the kind of thing I've been doing on my Fridays off.
Joe's employer took part in the four-day week trial when Joe was offered the chance to earn his full salary working 1 day less a week. He, rather incredibly, hesitated.
You were a bit sceptical about this, weren't you? Why?
Purely because it's so ingrained in my brain and everyone else's brain, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. To make it work, how do we deliver the same amount of work but only in 4 days?
That was the key challenge of the trial, to increase productivity by a whopping 25% to make up for the missing day. So how did the trial go for Joe's employer, the Tyler Grange consulting firm?
Well, it's been a fairly incredible success. I mean, we're making more money.
The boss, Simon Ursel, says it went so well he's made the arrangement permanent.
It's been quite an eye-opener at just how much you can get done if your whole business is really focused on trying to get 5 days' work done in 4 days.
He says his staff of 80 completed 1% more work in 20% less time by holding fewer meetings and making them shorter, by organising the week more carefully. The workforce, he says, has been galvanised by the prize of a three-day weekend.
That gives everybody an incredible sense of purpose and this incredible gift, which is time.
This small firm, called Five Squirrels, is another of the 70 companies taking part in the trial. It designs, manufactures and markets skincare products. Founder and CEO Gary Conway says the four-day week has been a rip-roaring success in retaining and recruiting staff in a tight labour market and in making money.
Revenue's up by 40%, retention's still 100%, nobody's left. Recruitment's become a lot easier. And generally, people just seem to be much, much happier.
The increase in productivity here has been extraordinary. One factor, says Conway, is what he calls deep work time, two-hour periods each day when staff focus exclusively on their own task in hand.
We switch off our emails, we switch off the phone, we switch off personal phones, we switch off Teams and all other communication devices, just so therefore we can get into that work.
A laser-like focus that doesn't sound much fun, but one member of the 14-strong workforce, Jade Panya, says no one here is complaining.
So far it has been like really, really nice because we have like the three-day weekend and we've got more time to relax, so it works pretty well.
She's taken up painting on her day off. Other workers in other firms in the trial have learned to sail and to horse ride. Gary Conway is learning to play the piano.
Which has been quite a challenge, which I've nearly quit about five times, but I'm persevering.
He's confident he'll profit from the four-day week as a businessman, if not as a pianist. At the Five Squirrels Company in Brighton, England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Come on, you gotta give it to that guy for trying with the piano, right? Coming up!
The coolest way to be cool is by wearing dorky clothes and pulling them off.
American Ivy, straight ahead. The pulling them off thing is the key there, right? First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 162 points today, about a half percent, 32,757. The NASDAQ down 159 points, 1.5%, 10,546. The S&P 500 slid 34 points, 0.9%, 38-17. Epic Games, publisher of Fortnite, will pay more than $500 million to settle with the Federal Trade Commission over violations of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. The FTC alleged that children and teens were exposed to trauma over the pairing of young gamers with adults, and that the company tricked people into making unintentional purchases. Comcast, the parent of Universal Pictures, declined about 1.5%. Paramount Global reversed by about 2.2%. Bond prices were down as well. The yield on the 10-year Treasury notes rose to 3.59%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now. A shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We've talked a couple of times in the past couple of months about the Colorado River, how low the water level in that river is getting, And how many people in the American West depend on it? Something like 40 million of us. Leaders of the seven Colorado River Basin states met in Las Vegas last week and got a talking to from the federal government. They said, the feds did, that the river's reservoirs could be just 2 years away from what's called Deadpool levels, which means they couldn't generate hydroelectric power anymore, which would be a very bad thing for the 40 million Americans who depend on that river. The basin states have until the end of January to agree on massive conservation measures, or the feds say they will decide for themselves. One solution that's on the table is paying users, farmers in particular, to leave water in the river. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more.
Farmers and ranchers use about 80% of the Colorado River's water. They also hold some of the most senior and entrenched legal rights to that water, rights that it seems the federal government would rather not challenge, says Sarah Porter with the Kyle Center for Water Policy.
There's an open question whether the federal government has the authority to cut deliveries.
She says paying users to leave water in the river is a lot easier than taking this issue to court. However,
I don't think that there will be enough uptake to stabilize the system.
So far, water managers have proposed using federal money to pay producers between $100 and $400 per acre foot of water conserved.
Producers are going to have to do some math and see if it pencils out.
Kyle Rohrink is with the Great Basin Water Network. He says some farmers and ranchers could lose money by allowing their water to prop up reservoirs.
But the gambit is, well, will the system crash?
Meaning there's not enough water to fulfill everyone's rights?
And then will I be subject to some other type of regime?
Which won't be as friendly to agriculture. Andrew Curley, a professor of geography at the University of Arizona, says managing demand with federal payments could help in the short term.
Whether or not it fundamentally changes the culture of water usage in the Colorado River, I think there needs to be more done.
He says that culture change is necessary because we need long-term answers.
Some of these solutions are trying to rearrange chairs on the Titanic.
Instead of dealing with the fact that the ship is sinking. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
If in your holiday shopping wanderings the past couple of weeks, or honestly your shopping wanderings almost any time of year, if you've come across a collared buttoned-up shirt, say, and could be described as preppy, you might have the campus of Princeton University, a 1965 book from Japan, and Ralph Lauren to thank, or blame, depending on how you look at it. I mention that by way of bringing up a podcast that, yes, I am late to, but also that in its most recent season is about that preppy look, that globally fashionable style called Ivy. The podcast in question is called Articles of Interest. Avery Truffleman is the host and producer, and I got her on the phone the other day to talk about her current season, American Ivy.
So Ivy was a super duper huge clothing phenomenon in the mid-20th century. And over time, it evolved into what was in the 70s and 80s called preppy style.
Right.
And what I argue now almost has no name at all. I mean, as menswear writer Derek Guy says on the program, you know, a button-down collared shirt is just a shirt. Khaki pants are just pants. But once upon a time, this was all part of a style known as Ivy.
Okay, so this is going to get a little meta here, but this entire season kind of is, and as I said before we turned the microphones on, I don't know exactly how this interview is going to go. So I need to stop here for a minute and talk about this idea that you talk about in the first episode of this season about trends.
Trends, yes.
Because that kind of is what has happened here, that Ivy was a thing, it became a trend, and now it is, correct me if I'm wrong, ubiquitous in what we wear.
Yeah, I think if you want to wear something to a job interview, if you want to look good on date night, this is a standard clothing style. You know, if we really trace the origins of where this comes from, it comes from the campus of Princeton, and it comes from Brooks Brothers. And it was once very much about looking white and looking rich and looking male. But this is where the study of trends come in. In the 20th century, We went from wanting to look rich to wanting to look cool. And the weird thing about it is, like, preppy clothes have changed with all of these trends. If you track it over the 20th century, it really says so much about the state of American desire in this fascinating way.
Which is really interesting because the roots of what we see now as Ivy started in Japan.
Oh, yeah. Ivy was exported to Japan by this one guy, by this guy named Kensuke Ishizu. And it really kickstarted the contemporary fashion industry in Japan. And Japanese brands then started to make American clothes better than American companies. And this is seen in very niche Japanese brands like Ivisu and Capital, but most notably, Uniqlo, if you look at it closely, is really doing a iteration of American mid-century preppy style, which they then exported and sold back to us. And we love it.
we do. But I was on that idea of us loving it and trends growing and becoming everything everywhere all at once, not to mix my, you know, media of all that, if you've seen the movie. Somebody in one of your episodes says the thing about trends that is so corrosive is that they get so capitalized because, and yes, you talk about this a lot, right? This is, it's all a business and you got to make money. And that's kind of why and how this happens.
It is why and how this happens. But I really think trends are, to some degree, innate in human nature. And yes, I think they can be corrupted by capitalism, just like love can be corrupted by capitalism, you know, for Hallmark Valentine's Day cards. And I think at the same time that Ivy style, preppy style, basic style, whatever you want to call it, has been sort of propelled by trends across the decades. Weirdly enough, it is also a way of resisting trends. And one person I interviewed said, you know, it is so cool because it is so dorky. And you look at pictures of like Miles Davis wearing button-down collared shirts looking so cool.
He looks so good. Yeah.
He looks so good. It's like the coolest way to be cool is by wearing dorky clothes and pulling them off. I think we are seeing a return of Ivy style now. You know, I know the pandemic isn't over, but as we're sort of emerging from our pods and looking around, the simplest thing that you can always, always, always return to make sure you look sort of baseline acceptable is Ivy. It's a trend that also resists trends.
We're kind of all reverting to the mean, right?
Yeah, in a way. Yeah.
This gets us chronologically out of order, but children of the 70s and 80s will not forgive me if I don't mention the name Ralph Lauren here.
Right? Oh, Ralph Lauren is a huge part of the story. I mean, Ralph Lauren began by working at Brooks Brothers. He was a salesman at Brooks Brothers when he was like 20 years old. Yeah, for 1 year. And he sort of got an idea of what the style was, but he realized they were sort of boxy. And he was like, what if I take this look and make it sort of body conscious, make it sort of sleek? And he did that. He made an updated version of Ivy and really summoned in the era of the preppy by introducing the polo shirt to the canon of Ivy clothes. And one of my favorite fun facts is what we now call the polo shirt was truly a tennis shirt. It was invented by a tennis player. And now we call it after Ralph Lauren's company. We call it after a different sport, which I think is very funny.
Do you think we can, just as a way to sort of put a punctuation mark on this, you at the end of this podcast sort of come clean a little bit and you say, you know, you had always thought of yourself as an outsider to this Ivy thing, but you looked around a little bit and you discovered you were actually in and of it. And I guess I wonder, Can the rest of us, can we all get away from it if we wanted to?
I mean, it's such an interesting thing, right? Because these clothes are so tied up with notions of class.
Yeah.
And yeah, I really had a reckoning at the end of it, which is that, you know, I went to prep school and I really did not like this style because I did not like what the private education system that I was a part of represented. And, you know, my theory that I have about it is that Ivy clothes represent everything that the Ivy institutions themselves are not. It is a relatively affordable accessible look that really is open to so many people. And it's so potent. I mean, that's why, you know, the far right were wearing khakis and polo shirts at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017. It's because this was a look that communicated openness and friendliness. And, you know, they sort of took that power of Ivy clothes and perverted it. But that's the fascinating thing about these clothes. They really have a power to them that's open to everyone, including me. And I realize instead of just denying it or trying to get away from it, maybe I should just embrace it.
It's a podcast called Articles of Interest. This season is American Ivy. This has been just a taste of it. I think it goes like 6 or 7 hours in half hour or 45 minute chunks. It is, let me tell you, it is well worth your time. Check it out. Avery Trufelman created it. She hosts it. She writes it. She does a bunch of stuff. Avery, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that the federal government probably ought not be actively trading in the commodities markets. But the Wall Street Journal does point out today that the Biden administration's release of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve have netted the Treasury Department more than $4 billion. The buy-sell math goes like this. Over the months that the White House has been selling oil from the SPR, 180 million barrels, if you've been keeping track, the average price has been $96.25 per barrel, a good 20 bucks or so above current market rate. The catch, of course, because there's always a catch in the commodities markets, is that at some point the government's going to have to start buying crude to refill the reserves. Buy low, sell high, right? All right, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context. Make of this what you will. Shares of Disney fell another 4.8% today. It's been a rough haul for the Mouse of House, or the House of Mouse, I suppose. Anyway, the entertainment conglomerate this weekend lowered its box office estimates for the new Avatar sequel. I'm just saying, 3 hours plus for that thing? Is anybody surprised? Don't at me on that one. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Guiong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.